This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
My name is Patrice Petro. I'm the director of the Carsey Wolf Center, and it is, as always, my great pleasure to welcome you here to the beautiful Pollock Theater, the kickoff of our conference. This, as I said, this marks the official start of our annual conference this year devoted to the theme of anonymous labor in film and media studies. I would like to thank Amy Villarejo for co-organizing this conference with me. Amy's in the audience. Woo! In some ways, this is a joint UCSB-UCLA endeavor, but it's so much more than that. As many of our presenters who come from all kinds of places. And for the first time in a couple of years, we have a fabulous weekend of weather for you. A couple of years ago, we were dying to be back together. We had a wonderful conference called Theory Now. There was so much energy that it rained the whole time. And last year when we were doing Mediating Deep Time, a little iffy, but by Saturday night, people were trying to get flights out early because they were going to get stuck. And Sunday, people were stranded everywhere across the country. So that's not going to happen this time. So you have much time to, for those of you who are guests here, there's going to be free time too for you to enjoy just relaxing, taking a walk, and more. But that's not for now, that's for later. Tonight, we're thrilled to screen a series of films that were curated explicitly for this conference by Maggie Hennefield and Michelle Baroudi. And I just want to say, I asked Maggie, knowing of her, all the work she's done, Nasty Women and all kinds of series that she's worked on, and I thought she would just give us an excerpt of something she had already done, but no, this is Maggie Hennefield. Tonight's program was curated especially for us tonight in relationship to this conference. As you'll see from your program, the screening includes five very different visions of anonymity and labor from the silent era to the 1970s. I am really grateful to Maggie and Michelle for curating this event. As they themselves remarked, and I quote, "The stakes of archiving anonymous labor in film history have never felt more urgent. Whether uncredited, invisible, overly palpable, or violently displaced, the specters of anonymous labor energize today's uprisings for liberation, pleasure, and social change," end quote. I will now turn the program, the podium, over to Maggie and Michelle, who are going to provide a roadmap for you, as you will see, and for what you're going to see and hear in the next 50 minutes of screening. After we watch the film, Michelle and Maggie and I will join you back on stage for a moderated discussion of tonight's screening and the larger project of curation in expanding and refining our understanding of film history. And following our conversation, we're going to have a lovely reception out in the Pollock lobby, so please stick around and join us for that. Okay, so on to Maggie Hennefield and Michelle Baroudi.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being here tonight, and thank you, Patrice, for that very warm, generous introduction, and for inviting us to curate the opening night screening of the Anonymous Labor Conference. Michelle and I were extremely excited to receive this invitation last summer. We might have had a little too much fun brainstorming various options for the program. I think we initially had over 4 hours of films on our shortlist. But basically, Patrice and Amy told us that the program should be no more than 40 or 50 minutes long. It's not actually 4 hours. That it should in some way engage with the larger themes of the conference, right, on anonymous labor. But other than that, we could do absolutely whatever we wanted, and we should try to put together the best program we can. Which is exactly what we tried to do. So we very much hope you'll enjoy the screening, and we're both looking forward to the conversation with Patrice afterwards. So under no circumstances should you leave this theater after the end of the last film. Stick around. Just a bit of context for what you're about to watch. So as you'll see, we approach the larger provocation of anonymous labor in the archive quite expansively to include films, films that both directly thematize the image of exploited labor, and also films whose missing production credits and provenance raise questions about all of the unseen and invisible labor in the film archive. So our program consists of 5 short films made from 1907 to 1977 in Germany, Iraq, Palestine, Italy, Egypt, the US, and Japan. Some of these films are complete, others survive only in fragments, and we ended up working with 4 different film archives to bring the whole program together. So I'm going to say a few words about the first 3 films, and then I will pass the baton to my dear friend and partner in crime, Michelle Baroudi. So as per our program subtitle, From Farce to Liberation, we wanted to warm up for the uprising to come by opening with a comedy. So the first film, Vendia, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this in German, but I'll embarrass myself by trying. Vendia, Film, Kleberin, Gebumelt Hat, right? Obviously, that translates to when the film editor dawdled, was made in Germany in 1925 by O.F. Maurer. And it's what's known as a culture film. It's a highly self-reflexive film that offers a kind of behind-the-scenes look at the everyday activities in a film editing room. So it stars the actress Alice Kempin as Fräulein Schroeder, who is a daydreaming film editor, or dawdling film editor, as per the title, who accidentally mixes up prestige review footage with assorted newsreels when trying to cut a feature premiere on an impossibly tight deadline, while herself somewhat hungover from a raucous night out on the town the night before. So film editing, or often referred to as cutting at the time, was typically viewed as women's work throughout the silent era, and frequently compared to other feminized crafts such as sewing, weaving, stenography, typewriting, and it was widely denigrated as such. So editing or cutting was not really seen as a form of creative intervention into the shaping of the film's meaning, but as a highly regimented task in service of a male director's overarching vision. So on the one hand, as you'll see, this film makes the uncredited labor of the dawdling editor palpably visible, right? The visibility of her labor sort of becomes the punchline or the butt of the joke of the comedy. On the other hand, once her hidden labor becomes visible, absolutely all hell breaks loose, right? So I think we can sort of embrace that visibility as a form of resistance in precisely that spirit, right? Because the golden rule of continuity editing in cinema, which we often call invisible editing, is that you're not supposed to notice the cut, right? The whole point is to hide the cut, to conceal the discontinuity between images so as not to disrupt the spectator's seamless absorption into the work of the narrative. And speaking of cutting, my pivot to the second and third films, the next 2 silent film fragments, the next 2 snippets we'll watch are both silent film fragments, both of which their authorial credits are largely unknown. So the second film in the program, The Kitchen Maid's Dream, will really go by in a flash. You'll see these incomplete fragments, which will actually be played out of order. They come from a lost film made by the Vitagraph Company in Brooklyn in 1907. And we actually don't know the director of the film or the names of any of the performers. All we know about The Kitchen Maid's Dream is that it was a trick comedy about an exploited domestic worker who fantasizes that she can dismember her own limbs to finish her housework for her on time. Well, I don't know, presumably the rest of her torso relaxes. So like the kitchen maid's disembodied limbs, the film itself survives only in pieces, which were recently digitized by the Library of Congress. They come from the Library of Congress's paperprint fragments collection. So actually the fragments we'll see only exist because US copyright law failed to cover motion pictures until 1912. So film producers had to submit illustrative sequences that were transferred from nitrate celluloid to positive light-sensitive paper. And the Library of Congress subsequently preserved these paper fragments on safety film. And since The Kitchenmaid's Dream goes by so quickly, it will repeat again after the third film, Las Horas del Asistente, The Assistance Hours, which is the third offering in our program. It similarly spotlights the image of exploited domestic labor, here performed by a young soldier who works as a servant in the home of an army officer. And I actually first saw this this film this past October at an annual silent film festival that takes place in Pordenone, Italy, where it's screened in a program called Cine Nomine, or without a name, Cine Nomine. So archives were invited to submit unidentified short films and fragments from their collections, and then festival goers would like try to identify them during the screening. So it became kind of a game, like, you know, audience members would try to shout out the title of the film during the screening if they recognized it, or at least to sleuth out further context about their production credits afterwards. So I'm happy to report that we now know the film company, location, lead performers, and approximate year when Las Horas was made. But I'm not going to tell you just yet, because I don't want to spoil your own fun in case anyone in the audience is able to recognize the film during the screening. And one last thing I'll say about this third fragment, the archive copy came from the Filmoteca de Catalunya, but it had no sound or music. So we commissioned a beautiful musical score from the incredible ensemble Sonas Lux Cinema, which is a feminist musical duo based in Puebla, Mexico. So the music you'll be hearing was composed and performed by Lorena Ruiz Trejo and Maria Fernanda Garcia Solar. They play the percussion and the piano respectively, but they also like bring in the xylophone, the glockenspiel, something called a thunder tube, as well as a number of different instruments. So I think you'll really enjoy that music. That is all I have on the farce and the fragments. And now Michelle will tell you all about Liberation.
That's a big, hefty order. Thanks, Maggie and Patrice. I am thrilled to be here with all of you in this beautiful theater, excited to share some of the work that Maggie and I do in the Twin Cities, in Santa Barbara, and to kick off what will be, I imagine, a really engaging and rich conference. As Maggie suggested, I'm going to speak a little bit about the pieces of our program today that reclaim and imagine depictions of resistance and liberation, and highlight the often erased and interconnected labor of anti-colonial filmmaking and archiving. These are the last two films in the segment. They're called The Field and Cowboy, which are both films that were made in solidarity with the Palestine Film Unit in the 1970s. And both were also recently rediscovered in Tokyo in 2016 as part of a collection that now goes by the name The Tokyo Reels. This cache of 20 16 millimeter films comprises works made by journalists and filmmakers from Japan, from Palestine, other Arab countries, and from across the international community, also European filmmakers. While many of the films in this collection were made and produced by the Palestine Liberation Organization, or the PLO, their film unit, which will become the Cinema Institute, the films that you actually will see today were funded and made by non-Palestinian Arab filmmakers, and they illustrate the networks of solidarity in both producing and archiving films about liberation. So the first of the two films that you'll see is called The Field, and it was made in 1977 and produced by the Iraqi Cinema and Theater Institute and directed by Sabih al-Zuhiri. As you'll notice, the film presents labor as a metaphor for political solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for freedom. This film portrays a fictional story of farmers tilling their land as if it's a training exercise for resisting settler colonial forces, using choreography and music to represent solidarity with Palestinians through a connection to both land and work. And I would suggest it also represents international collaboration as a necessary mode of resistance in both cinematic and revolutionary projects. The last film in the segment today, Cowboy, was made by Egyptian film critic Sami El Salmouni in 1973. And as you'll notice, the film links Hollywood cinema to settler colonialism through collage and montage, both to critique empire, but also to use these film clips and still images to reveal cinema's liberatory potential. The film reframes images from American Westerns, many that you will recognize, to visualize transnational solidarity as an appropriate and necessary response to ongoing forms of imperialism and colonialism, while also deconstructing and exposing the colonial apparatus at work in cinematic conventions and exhibition. So these two internationally produced films illuminate the interconnected work of restoring, compiling, and circulating fragments that might otherwise be lost in time. And it's worth noting that both films were produced as self-consciously collective political projects. And in this mode, they challenge the individualizing tendencies we ascribe to art making and envision resistance to colonial modes of production and preservation. The Fields and Cowboy and the Tokyo Reels more generally also explore anonymity in a different way, as a necessary and strategic tactic in archival work, insisting on preservation practices that attend to an archive always on the brink of erasure, while also safeguarding the individual members of resistance movements. These last two films open up the question of anonymity and the archive as a method of survival, as well as providing space to imagine what collective liberation struggle might look like. So whether through comedy, choreography, or collage, each of the films in this program, Maggie and I conceived, encourage us to see our struggles for recognition, dignity, and justice as intertwined. And I really look forward to our conversation after this screening and the rest of the weekend. Enjoy this cinematic foray into the various interpretations of anonymous labor in the archive. Thanks.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's Patrice Pietro here. I'm here with Maggie Hannafield and Michelle Baroudi, who curated tonight's program. So to begin, I just have a basic question, which is, so what was your process for putting this together? Tell us about your own key interests and research areas. I mean, it's two of you and how you come to this. And finally, why did you decide to do this and to include a range of cinema rather than like staying with the 20s or something?
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think this program really reflects a sort of larger process of collaboration. I mean, personally, I work on silent cinema, slapstick comedy, and gender, and Michelle works largely on Arab cinema and a political cinema. So I don't know, how many people in the audience can guess who chose which films in the program? Yeah, so I'm really interested in slapstick comedies from the early silent era, a lot of which directly represent images of exploited workers who rise up, like rebellious kitchen maids who break all of the dishes in the kitchen, and that's the entire film, or, you know, nursemaids who wage a general strike and then beat up the police force. So I really wanted my portion of the screening to speak to that. Also because a lot of these early comedies, like, they were wildly popular and were made for working class audiences. So that's kind of what I was thinking with the first three fragments. And then I think, yeah, so we had this big Google Doc where we were sort of brainstorming, but it was important to us to have like images and themes that recur throughout the program. So I don't know, one sort of resonance that I think really struck both of us when we were kind of reviewing the program as a whole, obviously the disastrous film within the film of when a film cutter dawdles is a total masterpiece, but it's also really problematic, right? These juxtapositions of like colonialist ethnography, you know, of like a black woman nursing her baby juxtaposed to, I don't know, like an image of like Lily White, Lil Dagover, you know, at the breakfast table. And it's really interesting how Cowboy uses, like, seizes on that disjunctive editing politically, right, to dismantle all of these kind of racist tropes of settler colonialism. So that recurrence was really crucial. But also it was like, I don't know, kind of playing a game of exquisite corpse. I think that the heterogeneity or just the kind of wild disjuncture across the five films was maybe part of the point. So just kind of taking a leap of faith and hoping that, I don't know, some of that broadness would be generative or at least evocative.
Yeah, and I would add to what Maggie was saying, you know, when we program together, a lot of times we program a festival together. We do Il Cinema Ritrovato on tour, a smaller version of the big festival in Bologna every year. And our two interests come together in very different segments. So it was really actually quite interesting, the process of working on one segment that reflected both of our research interests and our programming that we do collaboratively, but often in, you know, alongside one another, not necessarily together. And I agree that, I mean, the book ending with a film Cutter Dawdles and Cowboy really sort of pull the program together and point to some of, I think, the things that highlight what Maggie, the ways that our work complement one another, because as Maggie's sort of looking at exploitative labor in feminist silent cinema, a lot of the anti-colonial resistance cinema, especially films that were political cinema made in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, is providing a counter to that. In Cowboy, you see the ways that like exploitative labor becomes the, you know, the cause, the impulse to all of the violence. But it also, you see in the field a kind of counter to a kind of labor that isn't exploitative, but it is actually giving these workers agency, allowing them to, you know, rebuild their land each time it gets destroyed. And it's a very different representation of thinking about what labor can be. And so I feel like this program for us really, I think that was one of the ways in which we were thinking expansively about how do the archives that we engage with the most actually reflect on the questions of anonymous labor and like expose exploitation, but also a counter to that.
Well, before we turn to the conference theme, which I want to ask you about, I wanted you to tell us more about your local work in Minneapolis. You just mentioned, Michelle, that the film festival, El Cinema Ritrovato on tour, which you just completed last week, right?
Sure.
Presenting rare, restored, and recovered archival cinema. So how does this program tonight build on the work that you've been doing locally?
Yeah, that is a great question. So we just wrapped up our third annual festival last weekend.
It was four days ago.
Just the archives on screen all the time.
All the time.
So we started this organization called Archives on Screen Twin Cities a few years ago. You can follow us on social media. It's funded mostly by the University of Minnesota, which doesn't have a campus cinema, and we don't have celluloid projection on campus. And that's one of the long-term goals of our organization, to really establish like a film and media center and hub on campus. But we end up working mostly with off-campus venues. Like we do a quarterly series at the local rep cinema, in addition to our annual festival, Il Cinema Ritrovato on tour. So who is aware of Il Cinema Ritrovato? You guys know about Il Cinema Ritrovato. I mean, it's this massive annual archival film festival that takes place every summer in Bologna, Italy. So we have a deep sense of perversity by curating a satellite program in Minneapolis in February. and at Bologna, you know, and it features new restorations of like long unseen archival cinema made from the early silent era almost up to the present from all over the world. So last summer's Bologna screened like and like 450 films over the course of 9 days across like 10 parallel screens. And we had to narrow that down to 9 screenings. And we focused this year on women directors and feminist and anti-colonial cinema.
There's a theme.
There's always a theme. I just want to say also that we opened on Valentine's Day with a feminist satanic revenge comedy about cannibalism, and it was sold out, and it was like negative a billion degrees in Minneapolis, and people like came out to the theater to watch feminist cannibalism. So that's...
Yeah, that's it.
What more do you want? Yeah, I don't know why we didn't show more feminist cannibalism in each one.
For the future.
Anonymous labor of cannibalism.
The anonymous labor of cannibalism.
Yeah, in addition to that, we also, I think you mentioned we do this quarterly series, and we are always, those are like the two big things that we do, but we also are always programming. And we have a book talk coming up, and whenever things sort of come on our radar, we do them together. Another thing that we do in the Twin Cities, I am the film programmer for a local to the Twin Cities, a St. Paul-based Arab arts organization called Mizna, which maybe some of you have heard of. We do an annual Arab Film Festival, and then we have a quarterly film series that focuses on archival cinema from the Arabic-speaking world, and also we expand that to the whole Swana region, so Southwest Asia and North Africa. And Archives on Screen and Mizna partner a lot on those screenings, and we also partner with a lot of, in addition to local theaters and venues, we try to partner with other folks who are doing archival film programming around the Twin Cities, like local organizations and community groups, as much as we possibly can.
Very impressive. So let's talk about the screening's relationship to the conference theme, which I know you've thought of a lot about. So the theme of the conference really is to explore notions of labor and anonymity and invisibility. Now, obviously, this isn't so deep, but labor is highlighted in your program in various ways, from the film cutter's labor that has disastrous consequences, the kitchen maids and the assistants, exploited labor, domestic labor in two different fragments. And maybe just as a sidebar, you'll tell us why you repeated the breaking dishes. I actually thought we made a mistake when we were putting the pieces together. And the agrarian labor associated with political resistance in the first two of the Tokyo reels. So tell us about what you were thinking about representations of labor in these films and the connection to the problem of invisible labor in the archive itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was really the goal of the whole program. I mean, speaking of this kind of intersection between the sort of direct representation of exploited labor on screen and the invisibility of all the labor in the film archive, make that anonymous labor in the history of cinema more visible through these films that not only depict exploited labor, but often do so quite ambivalently, like most palpably in the case of When a Film Cutter Dawdles. And it's really obvious with both of the fragments, right, which not only are about the sort of daily mundane routines of extremely exploited domestic workers, but we know so little about the films themselves. And I mean, The Kitchen Maid's Dream, which I first saw in a flatbed viewer at the Library of Congress in like 2011 when I was researching my dissertation, that film was probably really labor intensive to make, right? Because it uses frame-by-frame, stop-motion animation of live-action bodies and objects and figures, right? Like, we briefly see the maid's disembodied hands washing the dishes, but the film, I think the whole film is like a few hundred feet long, so I think it was quite labor-intensive, and we don't know who did that work. We don't even know the director. And so I mentioned earlier that someone, a friendly festival-goer, had sleuthed out some further information about the assistant's hours. So Steve Massa, who is, I don't know, a human encyclopedia about like all of the history of cinema, but especially silent slapstick comedy, he wasn't at the festival, but someone posted images of the assistant's hours on social media, and Steve Massa identified the soldier and the officer were played by brothers, I mean, Ernesto and Ercole Vaser, who were both contract players for an Italian film company based in Turin called Ambrosio from 1909 to 1913. So just based on like a few frames, we know, yeah, like all this more information of the film. What it actually reveals or resolves is another question, but you know, the more you know. But I think just really briefly, that dynamic between like the image of exploited labor on screen and then the sort of like unseen kind of uncredited craft of the film is so interesting and complex and fraught with Vendia. And to give a brief plug, Mary Hennessy, who's a film scholar at UW-Madison, wrote a brilliant article on this film that came out in the journal New German Critique a couple of years ago. I highly, highly recommend it. And she really draws attention to, I don't know, the tension between Fraulein Schroeder's creative agency. She actually has quite a lot of power over the final cut, right? Even though it's an utter disaster, you know, there's no like male director breathing down her neck, telling her which shots to use, like where to cut and splice the film together. And I think that actually the film within the film is even better than the film itself. But the film is constantly trying to discipline the editor's own sort of like haphazard creative vision, right? With the spectators throwing rotten vegetables at the screen. And Mary points out there's even one scene where the invisible cut of the you know, main film saves the women editors in the editing room when they're like goofing off and doing the crossword puzzle. And we cut to the boss opening the door. And by the time we cut back to the room, they're like pretending to actually be doing their job. So it's, you know, there's a lot going on. There's more to unpack, but I've seen it.
Yeah, possibly.
I think to add to that, I would, you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting about a film like The Field, that, you know, as especially sort of seeing it, seeing all the films again in order and like thinking about them, I think that that film both, as I said before, you know, really like says some counters this sort of narrative of exploitative labor. But it also exposes something that I think is really important, specifically about the Palestinian film archive, one that has been plundered and destroyed multiple times, and is kind of in this constant state of having to sort of deal with whatever remains, that the film itself kind of like reproduces that kind of invisible archival labor, the work of actually having to sort of find, you know, rebuild from what gets destroyed. And so each time, you know, the tanks sort of come through and rip up the land that has just been sown, you see this, like a similar kind of process. It actually really mimics what will happen to the films that will, you know, be lost and not seen. And what it means to have to sort of reconstruct memory and archives from this constant state of destruction. But I also, something that I think is really interesting about that image in particular too, in this particular political moment, I think films from the distance that we have from films, these political films that came out in the 70s that show a kind of resistance that we just like don't really have a sense for in the mainstream. And not that these films were mainstream or popular in the way that the films, that the silent films were, but just that there's something about, and there's, you know, a lot of film programmers who also program political Arab cinema that I know are always really thinking about what, you know, how do we think about revolution and like, how do we actually draw that from the archives, like to produce labor in this moment, like that we need a kind of collective solidarity that we don't exactly have language for in the same way that in public spaces. So part of thinking about putting these films on screen and exhibiting them allows us to really think about, draw from the archive a form of labor that doesn't really exist in the present, in the way that, yeah, we might want it to.
So tell us a little bit about the score that you commissioned for the Assistance Hours from the two musicians based in Mexico City, or in Mexico?
In Puebla.
Oh, Puebla, okay. Mexico, yeah. Can you tell us about the process of collaborating with them on the composition for the unidentified film, which you told me was first screened in Pordenone?
Yeah.
In last October in a program of unidentified fragments. So how did you, I thought the score was fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, well, sitting in the, and I just wanted, you know, we kept trying to find that Glockenspiel.
Yeah, what was, did anyone know what the Glockenspiel was?
Sounds like.
Yeah. I meant to look at
it. I said,
the thunder tube.
I said, I think that's the Glockenspiel. And Maggie said, no, there's a xylophone.
Could have been a Glockenspiel.
Could have been, who knows?
Yeah, so I actually gave Lorena and Marifer very little feedback. They just knocked it out of the park on the first cut. I'd worked with them before. I first met Lorena at Pordenone. She was a student in the master's class. Their ensemble is called the Sonus Lux Cinema Ensemble, and it's mainly the two of them, but they work with different musicians. Lorena plays the percussions, Marifer plays the piano, and they actually composed a few scores for this DVD Blu-ray set that I co-curated called Cinema's First Nasty Women, which, just to like pivot to the QVC channel, we actually have a threadless shop. This is Leontine, so you can get a notebook or a hoodie or a magnet for your threadless store. Yeah.
Works for a lot of people.
Yeah, but they're brilliant. They, I mean, I just knew they would do a good job, and I love, like, they bring in really fun sound effects. Like, I think they're also just using found objects for the, like, you know, polishing the boots and the ticking clock and all of the, I mean, I feel like their instrumentation really draws out how, like, mind-numbingly tedious the soldier's labor is, but it's also a really fun and engaging score for the audience. So yeah, and they do a good job.
Yeah, it's great. So turning to the Tokyo reels that were thought to be lost before the collection was rediscovered, in Tokyo, and yeah, I think you said 2016 or 17.
2016, they were, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, but how does their rediscovery and subsequent circulation and restoration demonstrate what you've been talking about, the invisible labor involved in film archiving and the reliance on global networks and participation?
Yeah, so the Tokyo reels are an interesting story. The dates are, so in 2016, this filmmaker, Mohamed Yakubi, was in Tokyo presenting his documentary, Off-Frame Revolution Until Victory. And there was a Q&A, and afterward, an audience member just came up to him after the film screening and, like, handed him this list of films. And the titles were in Japanese and in English and in Arabic, and he, you know, like, figured out relatively quickly, like, this is like an archive. What is this list? Where are these films? And so the films were actually handed over in 2017 to Yakubi and Reem Shila, who works with him. They run Subversive Films. And so this collection they figured out through some research that it was housed in the PLO offices in Japan. And when those offices closed in 1995, I believe, someone just sort of like handed these films over to these two filmmakers and asked them to like safeguard this collection, who had just been holding on to them for all these years. And a lot of the films in the collection were films that archivists had been, like Palestinian film archivists had been looking for, and, you know, they knew a lot about but hadn't seen. And some of them were films that, like folks like Mohana didn't know anything about and had never heard of before. And so they're really interesting, I think, especially in terms of the Palestinian cinema archive, because it was plundered in the Palestine Film Unit, which became the Palestine Cinema Institute, had an archive in Lebanon that was like plundered and destroyed during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And the archive was like quite well constructed, and it wasn't just the films, but Khadija Habashna, who was one of the filmmakers who worked with the Palestine Film Unit, but was also the archivist, She describes it in her book, Nights of Cinema, where she talks all about, you know, it was like all of this material, all the ephemera that you would associate with an archive, equipment, and all of these things that sort of get lost. And so she and all of these other filmmakers start to go on this, like, you know, they start looking for films that have been plundered. They look all over. They go to private collectors. They go to Italy and try to find films that she knew her husband had left there. And, you know, so this cache of films that show up in Tokyo in 2016 was just like a, you know, the fact that they had 20 16 millimeter positive prints just in this archive that were, some of them were not in great shape, but some were in pretty decent shape and could just be digitized and shared. And they started, they had a film festival and started exhibiting them. But I think what's, I mean, for us, when we were talking about this program, what is interesting about these films is just that they expose the, you know, anonymous labor in the sort of international network of having to, how do we even like get some of these films, and especially in archives that don't necessarily have a place to live or that are always sort of under attack, like really rely on the sort of international networks.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you know, this conference seeks to catalyze reflection on the following questions, and some you've already addressed at length is, you know, how does one work with and on a silenced archive, the unarticulated in an artwork, a lost or destroyed document? We've kind of touched on this. And as we say in our conference program, you know, the means are often speculative, creative, and experimental, just like your curatorial work, I think, aims to be. But another question for this conference is, who decides whose story is told and why? Mm-hmm. And how important is it for you to affirm or give voice to anonymity? In other words, would you reflect a little bit on questions of anonymity? As I said, Amy Wood and I will have more to say tomorrow morning at the conference, but when we were thinking about this anonymous labor event, of course we were interested in, you know, silence, lost voices and documents and so on. But we also wanted to talk about the importance of anonymity and the kind of call to anonymity rather than simply a question of visibility.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if you had any final thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a beautiful series of questions, and I'm very excited to, you know, continue to unpack. Yeah, be talking about anonymity all weekend. I mean, I think I work on silent cinema, and because there's so much loss and anonymity in the archives, it produces this kind of like feverish obsession to know, to find the name, like who is that actor? What's the title of the film? It becomes this like all-consuming epistemophilia of the factoid or whatever. And like, I don't know, I think there are limits to that empiricism and, you know, like obsessive desire to like reveal the name. And just, I mean, because I have my Nasty Women notebook at hand, I am completely obsessed with this French comedienne who played a character named Leontine. And she had her own series that was filmed in southern France in the early 1910s. And like, I mean, she's a total miscreant. She like electrocutes the police and like floods and incinerates her home simultaneously. She strangles her neighbors with pieces of string. But we don't know the name of the actress, the performer who plays Leontine. And if anything, that's only fueled my total obsession and fascination with the character. And at this point, I don't think I even want to know who Leontine is. But I mean, one really interesting and important set of conversations that I think are happening in the field right now, like in feminist studies in particular, there's been this turn towards speculative historiographies of the archive, because it's obviously really overdetermined whose story gets told, right? Because some are prioritized for preservation and, you know, film history writing and curation over others. So I actually wrote a chapter about Leontine in this edited volume called Incomplete, the Feminist Possibilities of the Unfinished Film, that was co-edited by Alex Beeskin and Stefan Solomon. And I highly recommend it, right? And it's not just about lost films or even incomplete films, but also unmade, unrealized, and counterfactual films. So I think there really is a kind of vital connection between that speculative term in historiography and the larger conference themes of anonymity and labor.
Yeah, I was a reader for that volume.
Were you?
Yeah, that's why I'm certain that some of the ideas were percolating in my thinking about this conference.
Yeah, I think also, you know, thinking about critical fabulation and speculation and speculative archives, so many thinkers and filmmakers who work with Palestinian film archives, like Azza Al-Hassan. If you've never seen her film, Kings and Extras, find it and watch it. It's great. She's a scholar and also a filmmaker who made this incredible film that is searching for these archives and sort of like finding them buried in the ground and like finding people's private collections. But her... her recent book that just came out, and also in her film, she's always sort of talking about, you know, this idea of speculative archives that, you know, in when there is not, you know, when there isn't like actual archival material to work with, one needs to, you know, work with what they have. And she calls them the sort of visual remains. And also kind of has this sort of this refrain about, you know, the archive that's always like at risk of being plundered. But she also turns to, you know, and a lot of Palestinian filmmakers also kind of turn to sort of collective memory and embodied archives. So she, part of her project is this Void Project, which you can read about online. And she talks about it in her book as well, where she sort of reached out to folks who could anonymously share their stories or not. And so it allows her to sort of build from collective memory and actually like build a website and use these technologies to like form collective memory. And she like, so her work I think is really interesting in terms of this. But I also think one of the things that, you know, she and other folks talk about is just like this question of anonymity as a necessity, that, you know, that sharing these kinds of films, like the kind of ethics around it and like making sure that people are kept safe who made the films, or, you know, that there are lots of ways that like it's necessary to keep people anonymous. And so the way that also was something that Maggie and I were thinking about a lot when we put this program together.
Great. Yeah. So I think it's time to open things up to the audience.
Hello. Hello. Great. Happy to be here. Thanks for coming out here. I was just going to say, what was that French comedy you were talking about from
Leontine? She played a character named Leontine. And we include all of her films in the DVD Blu-ray set, Cinema's First Nasty Women. There were 24 episodes made from 1910 to 1912. A little over half survive. And they're really, like, when I filled out the BFI Sight and Sound poll of the, like, you know, greatest film, I got to pick the 10 greatest films of all time. And 6 out of 10 of my picks were from the Laurentine
Institute. Thanks so much for the series. I was wondering about the last film, Cowboy. It seemed that maybe there were credits for some camera crew or something like that. Were there, was there new footage shot for that film? Because it looked to me mostly like, you know, archived footage of other films or promotional materials.
I don't know the answer to that question.
They sort of track into the clip.
Yeah, and I feel like the filmmaking process does, like, the editing and the way that it moves between shots, like, that must be like the camera crew that was working on the film. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just, either I didn't hear it properly or I forgot because I'm tired, but I just wanted to know more about that last film because it's so fascinating. I can think of all sorts of influences coming together in that film. And so I'm just really curious about more meaty stuff about that, whatever you know.
There isn't a ton of information about the film. The filmmaker was an Egyptian film critic. So he was very steeped in cinema. And so, which you can see, right? He like clearly, like you can tell that whoever put that together, like knew the history of cinema and was like, also really well-versed in sort of thinking about how to, about editing. The editing is actually quite impressive. And also why I love the bookend of those two films of really thinking about the cut that calls attention to itself. And it's definitely not invisible. But those are the only things I really know about him. The films that were recovered, the information about them existed sort of like in kind of fragments. Some of them were written on cans and some of them were not. This is a film that folks knew a little bit about, but it wasn't as well known as some of the others.
Hi, I guess one question I have for you is, in doing archival work, are like names and titles sufficient in considering something to not be anonymous labor, or at what point would you consider something to be not anonymous?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, certainly knowing the title of the film and like, you know, basic credits for who worked on the production, who are the performers who are featured in the film is a start. But yeah, there's so much. I mean, I feel like you can never know enough about a film, and especially with silent cinema, right? 80 to 90% of all silent films ever made are now lost. And oftentimes, like, not even paperprint fragments survive. So a lot of the films, like the comedies that I research and write about, like, you know, maybe a very sketchy production credits, some archival metadata, if the film was preserved. But often I'm going on these very misleading synopses in film magazines and like trade press reviews, where like there have been times when I did finally go to an archive to watch early silent film comedy that wasn't digitized and had a completely different image in my mind based on the trade press review summary than what was actually included in the film itself. So I don't know if that answers your question. No amount of knowledge is ever enough to satisfy our hunger for, you know, resolving the anonymity of the archive. But I think that like, once you know a little bit, finding out a little bit of information about this performer who played the character Leontine, even though we don't know her name, we found her in other films that were shot in Southern France beyond her series around the same time. So once you like start sleuthing it out, you kind of know where to look and what questions to ask next and can kind of piece together a larger picture.
Lady?
I think with the archives that I work with, a lot of times, you know, there was like a crew of people who were often, you know, working together and working on a lot of the same productions. And so those names, you know, but then there are people who just show up once, who, you know, made one from and you know their name and you know the title, but you don't necessarily know very much about that person. And because of these sort of networks of solidarity that were like, you know, popping up all over, sometimes those filmmakers just worked on that one film or were just in that one film and that, or like an actor was just in that one film, and you know, most of them are not professional actors. And so you don't really know anything about, you know their name, but like Leontine, you don't know much about them.
We know that.
Sorry.
Well, thank you everyone for coming tonight, and please join me in thanking Maggie Hennefield and Michelle Baruti. So,
you've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.